Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, almost 20 years after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the Friends of Flight 93 Memorial will award selfless acts of heroism. But up front, more than 170 million Americans have received at least one shot of a COVID-19 vaccine. That's 61% of the eligible population, 12 and older, and 52% of the total population. But the number of people getting vaccinated has slowed down considerably and has put President Biden's goal of 70% being vaccinated against the virus by the 4th of July in jeopardy. Now incentives are being offered for more people to get shots. Ohio made headlines with Vax-a-Million, where any state resident who has received at least one dose of the vaccine could win a $1 million lottery prize drawing. Not to be outdone, New York, Maryland, and California, and now the city of Philadelphia, also incentivize vaccines through cash drawings. West Virginia is offering rifles. Businesses are also getting in on the action. United Airlines is now offering frequent flyer miles for the newly vaxxed. Do lotteries and incentives actually increase vaccination rates? There is science behind the initiatives. To tell us about research into these incentives are Dr. Nick Clark, professor of political science and director of public policy, and Dr. Matthew Rozu, professor of economics and dean of the Sigmund Weiss School of Business, both at Susquehanna University. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Dr. Rozu, Ohio actually saw a significant increase in the number of people getting vaccinated after announcing their $1 million lottery. But do we know whether these incentives are working or will work?
Well, first, thanks for having us on. And there is evidence that this would work. So to back up a little bit, Dr. Clark, myself, and a colleague from Kenyon College, Jay Corrigan, did some research with college students who hadn't received a flu vaccine. Now, it wasn't a COVID vaccine, but it was a flu vaccine, to look at the resistance to vaccinations. And these were students who hadn't yet received a flu vaccine in October. And what we found is many, of course, would be happy to get a flu shot for free, just like many are happy to get a COVID shot for free. But about half of the population required some amount of payment to receive that. And so we could think of these as people who might be resistant to getting a vaccine. But among those resistant to getting the flu vaccine, most did not require a large sum of money to get vaccinated. So over 95% of our population would have been vaccinated for $100 or less, and over 80% would have been vaccinated for $20 or less. So we found, with at least with a sample of college students, pretty significant evidence that really small incentives could move the needle significantly on vaccination rates.
Just to clarify, when you say for $100 or less, meaning that you would pay those people $100 or less to get vaccinated. Dr. Clark, your research was based on getting vaccinated with a flu shot, and it was college students. Is that a good representation or a good comparison between the general population and talking about a new vaccine against a deadly disease?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we were somewhat hampered by time in that when we conducted the research in the fall, of course, the vaccine was not available. We're in the process now of planning a similar study that will be based around the vaccine and will target vaccine hesitant people. But I will say a lot of this type of experimental research is often conducted with college students because it's conducted on college campuses, and that's the population that's readily available. And it's been found to be quite valid in terms of capturing broader public sentiment. In the case of our study, which was conducted with Susquehanna University students, you know, we do survey to capture the array of demographics represented by the participants. And much like the broader college campus, we found that it was especially representative when it came to political dispositions. And I think that's important with this because vaccine hesitancy increasingly aligns with political ideology. And so, you know, one thing we really wanted to get at was amongst people that don't want to get vaccines, whether it's the flu or COVID, and granted, there may be some unique circumstances motivating hesitancy with COVID, but we think that there's a broader sort of array of attitudes that are behind this. The question was, Is the resistance so insurmountable that there's no public policy mechanism that could be put in place that would make any difference at all? In other words, when we think of vaccine hesitant individuals, oftentimes we think that there's nothing that you could do to convince them to get the vaccine. And the reality is that many people have much less, I guess, strong reasons, I would say, to do it. Some just don't have the time. They don't want to get away from work, or they're afraid about losing out on work days. In some cases, there may be a fear of needles, although we didn't find that that was a particularly strong deterrent. But there's an array of other reasons that aren't necessarily as ideological, and which we think that different types of compensation may effectively address.
Okay, when you talk about political disposition, I'm curious about that, because even with flu shots, you found that a person's politics or their political beliefs influenced what they thought about getting a flu shot?
No, actually, we didn't see that as much with the flu shots as what appears to be the case with COVID. But it wasn't a strong intervening variable there.
Okay. I've been reading a lot about this over the last few days. There have been some suggestions that adding these making these incentives available could actually backfire, because those who are distrustful to begin with would think that, oh, you have to bribe me to get this shot. There must be something wrong with it. How can I trust you if you're going to pay me to get this shot, Dr. Rozu? Did you find any of that?
Well, yeah, we did not look at that specific issue. It's an interesting question on that. I would tend to, first glance, I tend to discount that criticism. First, many people had the opportunity to get the vaccine prior to any incentives being offered on this. And second reason I would discount that criticism is somewhat just the evidence that we have seen from states that have implemented, states like Ohio that have implemented the $1 million lottery for, one winner per week for the $1 million and the scholarship opportunities, right? There was an uptick in vaccination rates relative to what they had seen in the recent weeks. So in theory, I think that could occur. I would be doubtful that would actually occur.
Just yesterday, we spoke with a Washington Post reporter who had investigated one of the things that is happening across the country is that the virus is spreading amongst those who are unvaccinated. One of the things that he mentioned is that other than the people who have just are against the vaccine period and say they won't get vaccinated, is that there are people who have complicated lives, that low income, inadequate housing, lack of transportation, caregiving to others in the household, and the sheer burden of chronic illnesses are all factors that contribute to why they haven't gotten vaccinated up until now. And question has been asked whether financial incentives would actually be able to reach those people. What do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, on any sort of scheme that's trying to get incentives to people, right, you've got to make sure you do actually reach the people who you're trying to reach, right? Like, so that is absolutely clear. What we found, though, so a number of people, so in our sample, and I think that, we use college students as was mentioned, but a number of them did not say they'd get the vaccination for free. So they just, for whatever reason, they weren't going to do it for free, but they needed, say, $20 or something. And you could almost think of that as an inconvenience fee, right? Like, I mean, I'm sure a number of listeners in the audience get their flu shots every year, but a number who would say, I get it every year, probably missed a year or 2 years because life gets in the way, right? I mean, you want to get the flu shot, but you got a busy week at work and you forget to call. And then the next week you don't call. And then before you know it, it's February and you didn't get a flu shot that year. that certainly could happen a lot. And I think that the incentives could really be powerful for the individual who does have caregiving duties or who does have other obligations to get in the way. And there's also the interesting mix and really an interesting question on whether a straight cash incentive or, you know, free drinks or, you know, some of the other incentives that are being offered work better, or a lottery where there's this uncertainty, but you could win a massive prize. It's an interesting question on which might be more effective.
It seems as though in Ohio, the massive prize has attracted some people. But, you know, the president was talking about offering donuts or free beer or tickets to a baseball game. I guess if you're a person that is unvaccinated and those things were important to you, that maybe that's an incentive. But you wonder whether free donuts, free beer would attract that many people. You know, one of the things that I found interesting about your research is that you talk about how people don't really think about the probability of things. I mean, I know one of the examples you gave is people don't go into water sometimes because of sharks. They think about plane crashes. They think about kidnappings. Talk about that a little bit, Dr. Rozu. Do people understand probabilities, high and low probabilities, the chances of things actually happening?
In short, no. And none of us do, really. Planes are safer than automobiles, and yet fear of planes dwarfs fear of automobiles, right? You know, things like shark attacks, things like a one in a million chance of a blood clot from a vaccine versus the risks of dying from COVID, right? I mean, people constantly misestimate the basically highly publicized events that are very low probability. There's generally an overestimate of those happening. So on the negative side, right, when you hear of, oh my goodness, the Johnson & Johnson seems to have, you know, the potential of blood clots, this is really bad, and maybe I don't want to get the vaccine for that reason, or any other reason somebody might choose not to get a vaccine, right? It's a very, very low probability event that's scaring them off. And it's really relative to the illness itself, doesn't make sense. However, the flip side, this is where a lottery type system we might actually be able to capitalize on that, because winning a lottery is, of course, a really low probability event. If 5 million people are vaccinated and you're offering $1 million prizes, right? That's worth $1 per person in expected value, right? It'd be like buying a $1 lottery ticket. Well, that big prize may induce more people. Well, almost certainly would induce more people to go ahead and go get the shot, rather than just saying, hey, everybody, we're going to give you $1, right? Nobody would really, most people wouldn't care if you say, I will give you a single dollar if you go get vaccinated. But a shot at a one in a million shot at $1 million to many is more appealing than just receiving that dollar.
Dr. Clark, what are some of the incentives that you've heard about that may be some unusual? I mean, I mentioned West Virginia offering guns to those who you can win a gun, put it that way. Not that everyone who got a shot gets a gun. But what are some of the more unusual incentives that you've heard about?
I do think that is one of the more unusual ones, as well as the president's discussion of sort of beers or donuts in exchange for it. Our original proposal,
sounds like we're losing your Zoom, Dr. Clark. Dr. Rozu, let me ask you the same question. I think Dr. Clark was going to refer to some of your original research.
Sure. So the in terms of unusual incentives, right? The full scholarships, I think, are fascinating, and in terms of that, and I like that idea in the sense that it can reach an audience that they themselves, in terms of college students, are less likely to have severe reactions to COVID than most of the population. So a scholarship could help there. Illinois is giving out Six Flags tickets. There's one. The idea of free beer or free donuts or free cookies, a number of different incentives being offered. quite frankly, pretty unusual, but might move the needle in terms of getting people to go ahead and get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. You know, I talked in the introduction about President Biden's goal of 70% by the 4th of July. Do you think that with these incentives, and maybe even without the incentives, that that is doable, that we will reach that 70% mark? I mean, right now, like 63% for at least one shot, but the number of shots way down compared to, say, mid-April. Dr. Rosa, what do you think about that?
I wish I could give you a definitive answer on predicting predicting this behavior. Certainly, it seems like we'll have the capacity to do this. So it will come down to, do enough people feel incentivized to get vaccinated? I know a number of college campuses across the country are requiring vaccinations, so that might be an increase. You know, that might cause an increase in the number who get jabs. I wish I had a good prediction for you on whether or not that will indeed happen. It's looking at this moment slightly doubtful, but hopefully with more and more of these incentive schemes being offered, that we'll be able to reach that either by July 4th or shortly after.
Dr. Clark, are you there?
He is back.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Clark? It doesn't sound like we can hear him. So, Dr. Rosu, just to kind of summarize here, of the incentives that you think would be most successful in getting people to get vaccinated, what do you think would be the way to the incentive that could be most successful?
In some ways, I really like the lottery idea. I think a tax credit would have been easy. Dr. Clark and I and Dr. Corrigan from Kenyon College argued back in January that tying some of the third stimulus bill money, payment money, instead of simply giving cash to everybody below an income level, tying it to getting the vaccination would have been pretty strong, a pretty strong incentive. I also think there is a huge place for workforces and other businesses that wish to do this. A number of cruise lines are saying, if you want to get on the ship, you must be vaccinated. Right. So, well, if you've been looking forward to taking a cruise, if that's something your family enjoys and you were hesitant about the shot, you now have a decision to make. I either get to go on the cruise or, you know, but if I do that, I have to get vaccinated. So that, I mean, those can help universities, I think, that are requiring, hey, if you want to study in person, we need to have everybody vaccinated so we don't have to worry about outbreaks. So the government incentives, I think, can go a long ways, but I also think workforces, other, you know, entertainment establishments could also help encourage individuals to get the COVID vaccine.
Dr. Matthew Rosu, professor of economics and dean of the Sigmund Weiss School of Business, and Dr. Nick Clark, professor of political science and director of public policy, both at Susquehanna University. Thank you very much for being with us today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's program, high-stakes cases that may be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court this month or very soon. We'll have a preview of some of those cases coming up on tomorrow's show. As the country approaches the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the Friends of Flight 93 National Memorial here in Pennsylvania is working to keep the memory of that day alive. They are sponsoring an annual award in honor of the heroes of Flight 93 who are credited with taking control of the hijacked jetliner targeting the U.S. Capitol or the White House. The Flight 93 Heroes Award will recognize selfless acts of heroism and keep the memory alive of the sacrifice of the 43 passengers and crew members on that fateful flight. Joining us is Donna Gibson, president of the Friends of Flight 93 National Memorial. Ms. Gibson, welcome to the program. Donna Gibson, are you there? Well, hopefully we'll have Donna Gibson here in just a moment. If you have a question or a comment talking about this 9/11 award, Friends of Flight 93 award, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Donna Gibson, are you there?
I am.
Okay, good. Welcome to the program. This award that we're discussing is about much more than just recognizing someone, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's actually about recognizing and honoring the heroes of Flight 93 National Memorial and using an award as a way to elevate the recognition, the education, the efforts that we put forth at Flight 93 National Memorial, and make sure that the 75 million Americans who were not alive at the time of September 11, 2001, learn about the events of that day.
You know, it probably takes some people by surprise to hear you say 75 million Americans have been born since those terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. Those are 75 million people who didn't live through it, so they have to be educated about. And we'll talk more about that education component of this in just a moment. How did the award, how did you decide to come up with an award for this?
Well, I think it was through a series of strategy conversations with family members, board members, our PR consultant, and talking about, you know, what better way to honor those 40 individuals than by naming an award, the Flight 93 National Memorial Award, and to recognize individuals who have, you know, demonstrated bravery and courageousness and put themselves at risk as those 40 heroes did on September 11th, 2001.
You know, you mentioned the family members. 20 years later, how much input do the family members of those passengers and crew still have into decisions made by the Friends of Flight 93 Memorial?
Well, not only just the Friends, but also the National Park Service. We consider ourselves to be a four-legged stool. So we have the Friends of Flight 93, the families of Flight 93, the National Park Service, and the National Park Foundation. We are the four organizations that basically make the decisions for what happens at Flight 93 National Memorial.
So we've touched on the criteria, but if you could be a little more specific, what will the criteria be for this award?
Sure. It will be individuals who demonstrate bravery, courageousness, and put themselves in danger to help another individual. And, you know, in an earlier conversation that I had with somebody, one of the things I talked about were, you know, through COVID, we've had all kinds of heroes step up. Many of my friends are retired nurses who have went back into the medical field to help with giving injections. So they're taking themselves out of a safe place, being in their home and being quarantined, to go out into the medical community and help to make sure that they're taking care of their communities.
We talked about this award being about more than just recognizing someone, that education about Flight 93 is the goal. Why does that public, 75 million people we mentioned born since then, but why is there a greater need for education about Flight 93?
Well, I think one of the things that we've learned over the years is, you know, New York and the Pentagon memorials, both are in metropolitan areas. So by just the nature of where they're located, they get a lot of visitors, they get a lot of publicity. About 2 weeks ago, I was at the memorial and I happened to run into a mother with her children. And the mother was very engaged with helping her children understand about the memorial and what happened there. So afterwards, I engaged in a conversation with her, only to find out that she was a military mom. And she wanted her children to understand that these 40 people acted in face of adversity, and that that's what Americans should do. That although she's in the military, she signed up for that. These 40 individuals didn't sign up for that. And, you know, she really felt that it was important for her children to know that. And then in follow-up, talking to her children, the one son basically said the same thing. Like, we know about New York, we know about the Pentagon, it's, you know, people don't know about Flight 93. And he was really looking forward to going back to his hometown to be able to tell the story of what he learned while he was at the memorial that day.
You know, here in Pennsylvania, I think that Pennsylvanians may be a little more educated about 9/11 and Flight 93 than maybe the rest of the country. But as you suggested, that New York, Washington, being in urban areas, they get visitors all the time. And, you know, many people make those sites, their 9/11 memorials, destinations. There, that, not to say that doesn't happen in Somerset County, but just fewer people there to begin with. You know, one of the things that also strikes me is that, you know, we often wait until the anniversary of the terrorist attacks to talk about Flight 93, and actually even New York and Washington as well. We're coming up on the 20th anniversary. So, yeah, here we are talking about it. But why is it that we as a country have to use anniversaries to talk about something?
I can't really answer that question. I just know that we know that the memorials, the 9/11 sites, will get more attention this year. So we wanted to piggyback on that attention and make sure that Flight 93 gets their share of the education and the media exposure as the other two. And, you know, with the hope that with that media exposure, we're able to educate more people about what happened that day. And, you know, it's just truly the story of those 40 individuals is just a amazing story that I don't think many people know about. They know there was a plane that went down in Shanksville, but to know the details of their stories of those individuals is just something I think that should be taught in history classes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. How is it taught in schools today, or how's it, and what should be being taught in those history classes?
Well, at this point, what we've learned is it's not a mandatory educational criteria. What we do know, though, is that a lot of teachers will teach. And so as the Friends of Flight 93, we've made it our mission to make sure that there are educational resources available to teachers throughout the United States and the world if they need it. But especially through the pandemic, we found because we weren't able to bring students to our site to do the tour and the education program that we have on site, we put together virtual training packages. We've partnered with the National Park Service to develop a distance learning studio where we can virtually teach students anywhere in the world from that studio.
You know, one of the things that is unique about the Flight 93, and actually you think about it probably because it's been within the past 20 years, is that there is so much material which isn't typical of a history course, meaning those voice recordings from the passengers, the notes that have been left, you know, all the things that people who have visited the site have left there. That so there is a lot of resources for students to use and teachers to use that is not typical of a history class, of say something you would learn from the Civil War, for example.
Sure. And I know that one of the programs, several of the programs that we do prior to students coming to the site, teachers will do an exercise with them where they will have the students each pick a passenger or crew member to learn about, so that when they get to the memorial, they've had a little bit of knowledge about, you know, what happened on that plane, who the people were on that plane. And then it, I think it makes it a more meaningful experience for those students while they're here.
I have to say that I'm fascinated by some of the questions that have been asked over the years. One that has been asked fairly often, I understand, is that many young people who visit the Flight 93 Memorial ask what an answering machine is.
Yes.
Because yeah. that's you know, one of the things that they can hear is those voice recordings, but those recordings in 2001 were on answering machines. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I had a group of younger adults one day and a group of Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, and, you know, we were talking about the voice recordings, and after they listened to them, they were asking me, well, how did they get those messages off of their cell phones? And so I said, well, you know, back then cell phones were not something that was that prominent. Like, those were left on answering machines at people's homes, and they had no idea what an answering machine was. So that just goes to show, you know, I think 9/11 was one of those last events in history that happened before there was social media and all of the frenzy that people could have been taking pictures and posting on Facebook or Twitter or, you know, whatever medium they use.
Let's take a phone call from Joe in Dallastown. Joe, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Scott.
And, good morning.
It's a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day in Pennsylvania. The reason I called is just serendipity. I was in New York City yesterday at the 9/11 memorial. So the impact of the whole event is real to me. And the reason for my call is to support your guest in the education needs about Flight 93. So in that entire memorial, which is very moving, very detailed, there was very little about Flight 93. There was a very small section that had a photograph that always moves me on how the community around Shanksville put that little shanty up. And many should be aware that there was like a cyclone fence erected, and people from all over would just show up and put souvenirs and memorials and clothing and emblems and that sort of thing. So I hope that the education efforts will reflect on the years leading up to the National Park Memorial, where it highlights the coming together of the community so that that story can be told. In New York City, they... and I just heard your guest mention those answering machines. In New York City, they had recordings of people calling in on answering machines. And I guess part of the issue about educating about Flight 93 is that there were so many limited phone calls from passengers that less is known about Flight 93. But I think we have enough information to highlight it all. So,
hey, Joe.
I just wanted to pass that along.
All right. Well, Joe, thank you very much for your call. Donna Gibson, it's you know, it's exactly what we're talking about. When he's, you know, I assume he's talking about 9/11 overall at the 9/11 Memorial in New York, not mentioning much about Flight 93, which, I don't know, it seems kind of unusual to me.
Right. And to Joe's point, so from Flight 93, there were 37 phone calls made from the plane, most made from airphones, made to loved ones or to the airline. So there were 37 phone calls made on that day.
You know, another question that I saw was recently asked is, if the national park was there when the plane crashed, this is from a young person.
Yes. So, you know, it's interesting because they wonder, did the plane crash there because it was a national park service? Interestingly enough, several weeks ago, again, I was at the memorial and a group of high school students were there. And one of the questions that one of the high school students asked was, did the plane crash because the president ordered all of the planes out of the sky that day? Which, you know, was quite interesting because she had just went through the visitor center and heard some of those comments about all of the planes were required to land. And so not understanding the whole story or what happened that day with Flight 93, she just assumed the plane crashed because the president ordered all of the planes out of the sky that day.
Wow. It just goes to show that, you know, for those of us who live through it, it's hard to believe it's 20 years, but that some of the things that are misunderstood. We only have about a minute or so left, Ms. Gibson, and I want to thank you very much for being with us today. There are nominations being accepted for this award, but what is the ultimate goal here?
The ultimate goal is, one, to recognize an individual for their acts of bravery and heroism, and two, to really elevate the story of the 40 passenger and crew members and to make sure that America never forgets about what happened at Flight 93 National Memorial.
Well, I would encourage everyone within earshot, if you haven't already, to visit the memorial. It is very moving. And even if you can't visit, to learn more about it, because it just seems as though all the time there's so much that we can learn. Donna Gibson, president of the Friends of Flight 93 National Memorial, thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me. And also, if you can't visit, if you go to flight93friends.org, there is a virtual tour so that you can do the virtual tour in preparation of visiting us or in lieu of visiting us. So we would welcome you to sign in and look at what we have available.
We'll put that on our website, a link on our website. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
This is a previously recorded segment of Smart Talk. Please do not call in with your questions or comments.
Are you one of the 1 in 3 Pennsylvanians who has received an unexpected surprise medical bill? One that you thought was covered by insurance or that was way higher than you expected? There's legislation in Harrisburg that would control surprise bills, but it doesn't seem to be going anywhere at the present time. Joining us is Patrick Keenan, Director of Policy for the Pennsylvania Health Access Network, to talk about surprise medical bills. Mr. Keenan, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for having us on today.
If you have a question or comment, maybe you have experienced this, 1 in 3 people. Actually, I'm surprised it's not more people that have gotten surprise medical bills. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Patrick Keenan, why does it happen? Why are there people, so many people, who are getting surprise medical bills that they didn't expect or they thought were covered?
Well, Scott, that's a really great question. I think the answer is most people are getting these bills because they think they're doing the right thing, and they are doing the right thing. They're looking at their provider networks. They're trying to stay in network, but unfortunately, at no fault of their own, they end up out of network. Let me explain. Let's say you have a scheduled surgery that your doctor has recommended. You picked a hospital that's in network with a surgeon that's in network. And, you know, just as that surgery is about to begin, of course, an anesthesiologist walks in and asks you to count backwards from 10. And that's not the moment where you should be asking them, hey, are you a network? Because what often happens is invisible providers, providers that patients don't regularly see, are often the ones that end up out of network, even though they're in an in-network setting. And what happens is that patient ends up with a very large bill for those services that's not covered by their insurance because it wasn't in network. This is also incredibly common in emergency situations as well.
And I want to talk about emergencies in just a moment, but just to provide some context for what you were describing, there was a study by researchers at Yale last year that found that in-network hospitals, about 11% of assistant surgeons, 12% of anesthesiologists and pathologists, and 6% of radiologists were out of network. And as you describe that situation, someone's about to undergo a procedure, about to go into surgery, not a time to ask, hey, are you in network? And even if that person said no, what are you going to do at that point? So it just kind of backs up what you were talking about. You know, I've often wondered about emergency situations. You're on vacation. You're traveling. Something comes up. You have to go to the emergency room, always wondering whether you are covered or not. Is someone covered if they go to an emergency room outside where they live?
So Pennsylvania law doesn't adequately cover or protect most patients right now from getting hit with surprise medical bills. We have limited protections that apply differently to different kinds of plans. It's complicated. And what we're advocating for is a simple, straightforward law that keeps consumers out of the middle. That's the most important thing. Consumers need a protection that guarantees them that when they end up in these situations, you know, they're not stuck with this big bill that they could do nothing to avoid from these invisible providers or in these emergency situations. And that's what we're advocating for. So the answer is, you know, we need better protections, and we certainly, most consumers aren't protected at the moment.
So let's talk about right now, and then we'll talk about this legislation of what you're looking for. As of right now, what happens if a consumer gets a surprise medical bill? What recourse do they have?
So I think the thing, when we looked at this with the Healthcare Value Hub out of Washington, we found that most consumers don't know where to turn. As a matter of fact, you know, most of these bills end up either in collections or, you know, incurring more debt on the consumer. And they simply go unpaid, or if it's small enough, most consumers end up paying it. And that's unfair to Pennsylvania families. They shouldn't have to pay these bills that they really, you know, had no choice in whether or not they were generated. So those are the two most often things. They either end up in collections or people pay them. Pennsylvanians, as I said, have limited recourse, and they can contact the Pennsylvania Insurance Department or an organization like ours, the Pennsylvania Health Access Network, and we can kind of guide them through ways in which they might be able to get help. But as I said, under current law, there's lots of holes in those protections, and most are unprotected at the moment.
Are there a large percentage of people who are maybe about to go into a procedure or, you know, some type of treatment, who check ahead of time and find out that, are told that everything is in network here? They go to a provider, they look at the list of in-network providers, they end up going to somewhere, and, you know, as I mentioned, that 11% of assistant surgeons, anesthesiologists, pathologists, radiologists that are out of network that end up working on the procedure as well. My first question is there a large percentage of people who do some checking ahead of time?
Absolutely. Pennsylvania families are doing the right thing. They're checking their network directories. I mean, I think this has kind of been ingrained in our mindset, right? You know, we ask that question, you know, by and large, right up front, or, you know, most of the time, you know, we're being told, whether or not someone's in network. Most Pennsylvanians are walking into this situation where they're, you know, believing, based on their own research and what they've heard from staff, that, you know, everything's going to be in network. So that's the largest problem there, is that people have a false sense of security that they're actually protected when they're not.
Hence a surprise medical bill. So the legislation you're referring to, it made it out of the House late last year, or excuse me, out of a committee late last year, hasn't gone to the full House for a vote yet. What would it do? What would that legislation do?
So House Bill 1862, the Surprise Balance Billing Protection Act, it's the strongest protection for consumers. It keeps them out of the middle and ensures that, you know, all they're responsible for is what they would normally pay under their health plan, what, you know, their in-network cost sharing. It establishes a fair and equitable process for paying providers for those services, while at the same time, and this is really important, the protection would not add to costs that consumers face, like increased premiums or increased out-of-pocket costs. We want to make sure that consumers gain a protection but don't end up losing their coverage because their premium went sky high, or they can no longer afford their copay to go to the doctor.
Let me.
1862 does exactly that.
This is bipartisan legislation, by the way. But there are doctor groups and hospitals that have pushed back against the proposal, arguing that it gives unfair advantage to insurers who may use the new rules as reason to drop them from their network doctors who contracted rates above the baseline payment. So in other words, limiting some choice there for patients if you want to look at what the result would be. What about that?
So much of that is fear-driven. There's no good evidence from states that have adopted solutions. I mean, 15 states have already passed laws that protect consumers from surprise medical bills. Of those states that have used a model similar to what we're advocating for here in Pennsylvania, there's no evidence that that has actually happened. That's you know, often kind of playing to fears. I think the important thing to know is that the bill that we're advocating for uses a market-driven solution. So it uses the existing negotiations that go on every year that providers are participating in and health plans are participating in to resolve these bills in a fair way from consumers. What providers are pushing for, and many of the groups that are pushing for, you know, other solutions, are actually part of these Wall Street-backed private equity firms that are profiting off of surprise medical bills, you know, taking more money from Pennsylvania families than is you know, necessary or reasonable, because, you know, that's how they make additional money. Those groups are advocating for solutions that would raise premiums and raise out-of-pocket costs, and that's unfair to Pennsylvania families.
We only have a minute left. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Keenan. As I mentioned, this came out of committee late last year. You and some other groups and some people who have been have received surprise medical bills rallied last April. You're having another rally today. What's the holdup?
Pennsylvania lawmakers simply should not go home without bringing relief, you know, to Pennsylvania. COVID has made this problem even bigger. When people have fewer choices of where they can go to get care, you know, they're stuck in these situations. And we see, you know, in this current environment, more than one in three Pennsylvanians are getting these surprise bills. So in our mind, from the consumer, you know, standpoint, there shouldn't be a holdup. Pennsylvania lawmakers owe it to Pennsylvania families, you know, to pass 1862 and move forward with getting us real protections.
As I said, this is bipartisan. Have you seen any kind of movement from legislators away from supporting this?
We have not. In fact, you know, we hear more and more that you know, constituents are contacting their lawmakers and asking them to pass these protections. So, you know, there's growing support. And as I mentioned, in the current moment, you know, with COVID, you know, exacerbating this problem, you know, we've seen both at the federal level, you know, the federal, the president and federal lawmakers have agreed that this is a problem that's happening more frequently and needs to be addressed. Pennsylvania has this opportunity. We're much further along, and really, you know, that bipartisan support should move this bill forward.
And from what I understand, there are some members of the Pennsylvania legislature waiting to see what happens on the national level. Patrick Keenan, Director of Policy for the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Mr. Keenan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Scott.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health, online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.